This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us for hour number two of the program. Harriet Williamson is the producer, and Jason Croft is at the controls for this hour. Kyle Mabry was on for hour number one. When selecting food for their dinner tables, there's a growing number of people who are looking for food that is produced close to home. Their hope is that by doing that, they will accrue a number of benefits, and that overall that will be good for food security, not just for them, but for everybody. Our guest for this hour of the show, he is an economic geographer from University of Toronto. His name is Pierre Desrochers. He says that while that might seem like a good idea, in fact, eating locally does really very little to solve our serious global food problems. In his book that we'll be talking about here this morning, titled The Locavore's Dilemma, he takes on some of the key points of the Eat Local agenda, including the ideas that local food is better for us and for the environment. So we'll talk about some of his ideas and give you a chance to react in this part of the show. The book, The Locavore's Dilemma, is published by Public Affairs Book. The co-author on the book is Hiroko Shimizu, who happens to be his wife. And we're pleased that he could spend some time talking with us about the book this morning. Again, Pierre Desrochers is an associate professor of geography at the University of Toronto and writes often on economic development, globalization, energy, and transportation issues. As we talk, questions and comments, of course, are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. And we have email. So if you would like to send along a question or a comment that way, you can do that too. And the address is will-talk. And that is the address. And so we'd be very happy to have your comments that way. Will-talk at illinois.edu. And Professor Desrochers, hello.
Hi.
Thank you very much for talking with us today.
Well, thanks for having me.
I appreciate it. I think that I was interested in just because it this goes head on against a set of ideas that these days are becoming very popular. I expect some people probably will not like what you have to say. You're certainly going against, seem to be going against a trend. What was it that that got you to dig into this?
And so controversial.
Well, in short, yes.
Well, my wife, to be honest. You didn't mention that she was my co-author, so to make a long story short, about 5 years ago, we did attend a talk by a very prestigious Canadian environmental scientist who was singing the praise of locavorism, which is what this whole local food movement is called. And unlike many other locavores, he did take the movement to its logical conclusion, or at least the idea to its logical conclusion. And at one point in his talk, he said, well, obviously, the Japanese are the most parasitical people on Earth because they import more food than anybody else. Now, as the name of my wife might tell you, Hiroko Shimizu, she was born and raised in Tokyo. And, yeah, so I had to sort of calm her that evening and promise her that I would debunk these ideas. So, honestly, this is how I got into this.
Now, and I think that probably for us, for some people, if you start talking about locavorism, what they'll say is that, well, it for them, it just means to the extent that they can, they would like to patronize local producers, local growers. They go to the farmer's market. There, we have a very nice co-op here. So it's, I don't know.
No, which is fine. And I mean, if it was only that, we wouldn't be writing a book against that movement. But there are two issues. I mean, if you're going to be serious about local food, you must at some point promote expanding local food production against food that you import from other locations. Otherwise, in season, everybody buys local when it makes sense. I mean, when you get a better quality-price ratio for the food you buy. So good quality, affordable local food does not need a movement. But unfortunately, this movement is becoming increasingly coercive. So you have a number of activists now who are pushing penitentiaries, school boards, university, all sorts of government agencies, even the U.S. military, to purchase more local food, even though it is more expensive and of lesser quality than food that you can import from some distance. I mean, nobody would go through the trouble of importing food in the first place if it did not have some obvious advantages over local food. So again, if it was just a fad, if it was just patronizing local people at your farmer's market when it makes sense, well, we wouldn't need to write a book, and honestly, you wouldn't have a locavore movement. you only have a movement because you want to push local food beyond what is reasonable. And this is the idea that that's set against.
Just to plunge in here, asking some of the basic questions, I guess that one of the arguments that people make for being a locavore is that they're interested in the environmental impact of how they live their lives, their carbon footprint, so to speak, and they would argue, well, isn't it better if we don't have the environmental consequences of transporting foods for long distances? Isn't it better if I get my food locally, because then we're not dumping carbon in the atmosphere that involves trucks and planes and ships and getting people from getting food wherever it's grown, which may be a long way away, to where I am here?
Yeah, well, forgive my Catholic upbringing, but, you know, it was drilled in my little head that, you know, the road to hell is often paved with good intentions. And this is a typical case here. So I grew up in the countryside myself. My parents had an apple orchard. And what happens in Quebec, in the St. Lawrence Valley, where I grew up, is that you typically pick up your apples in September. So if you want to eat them in March or April, well, obviously you need to put them in cold storage. This requires a lot of energy, carbon dioxide. You have unavoidable losses to spoilage in the process. But then what has happened in the last few decades is that we began importing apples at certain times of the year from the southern hemisphere. And the advantages that locations like New Zealand, Chile, Argentina, or South Africa have is that their summer happens to be our winter and vice versa. So they do pick their apples around March or April in most places. So picking up apples in the southern hemisphere, putting them on a container ship, which is by far the greenest mode of transportation that humanity ever devised. I mean, you can ship an apple from New Zealand to North America for about 1 cent. I mean, a boat floats. It's powered by bunker fuel, which is low-grade fuel, very powerful diesel engine. It's extremely efficient. So you get these apples from the southern hemisphere to the northern hemispheres maybe 2 weeks later, and you did not have to power again to refrigerate that warehouse for several months, and you have a lot less losses due to spoilage. So at certain times of the year, importing produce and fruits from the southern hemisphere does make sense, and is not only more economical, but also more environmentally friendly. And there are other advantages, too. I mean, if you locate food production in the world's best location, so my understanding is that you're in corn and soybean countries, you have much better conditions to grow them there than in other places that do need to feed their chickens or their hogs. So it makes more sense to actually concentrate corn and soybean productions in the world's best location and ship that stuff to, let's say, a place like China, where they don't have room to grow these things, or if they were to grow them, they would have to grow them on hillsides or locations that would deliver much lower yields than central Illinois. But by importing feed from central Illinois, they're able to feed their hogs, they're able to feed their chickens, and to deliver cheaper food, better quality food to their residents, while having a much lower environmental impact. So again, specialized food productions where they make the most sense, and trade them typically by container ship, where the energy signature is really tiny, and you will be able to spare more land in that process, especially marginal agricultural land that is often prone to erosion. So overall, nature benefits that way too.
So you're making the argument that having a globalized food system makes sense both environmentally and economically.
And economically. I mean, if your goal is really to reduce carbon emission or to spare nature as much as possible, the global food supply chain is the way to go. I mean, all the evidence on this is clear.
We have a caller. Let's take them right away here in Coles County on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Yes, I this movement to grow your own natural foods, I think, is a good movement. I'm all for it, but I do get a kick a little bit out of. It seems like there are a lot of people involved who somehow think that this is a way to have a revolution, to change society completely to sort of a leftist, progressive society, and peacefully and nonviolently and so forth. And, you know, in the process, put a bunch of major food corporations out of business, giant corporations, you know, bring about a lot of progressive change in society. And I don't think that's quite the case, although I am all for it. To the extent that people do this, it's fine with me. I think it's a good idea. But I do get a kick out of the fact that so many people seem to think that they're really transforming society in a revolutionary manner. And I don't think it's going to quite be that significant. Thanks very much.
All right.
Okay. Well, no, this is exactly right. I mean, I have a PowerPoint presentation on my book, and I have an image which is exactly that, where the hammer and the sickle has been replaced by, you know, a little shovel or something, you know, and people say, well, this is the new way to change society. But what these people fail to ask themselves is that, well, you know, if things were so great in the past when most food was local, why did we develop the globalized food supply chain in the first place? So your caller is absolutely right that many people view that as a way to fight globalization and large corporations. But what they fail to ask themselves is that, well, you know, until the railroad came along and the steamboat and steamships, most food in most places was produced locally. And people were miserable. They were much smaller than today, several inches smaller than today. Life expectancy was several decades shorter. And no matter where you were in the world, relying on a local food supply was extremely problematic in terms of food security because you would have bad years and two bad harvests in a row and you would have a famine. And it didn't matter if you were in southern China or northern Europe or what have you. What put an end to that was long-distance trade, which made it possible to channel the surpluses of regions that had good years to regions that had bad years. And, you know, the regions that had good years and bad years would never be the same from one year to the next. So long-distance trade, the globalized food supply chain, is a basic way to manage risk. I mean, you're in central Illinois. I'm sure a lot of your listeners are very knowledgeable about agriculture. Not everyone can have good years. Not everyone can be in good locations. And famines and malnutritions were basically ended in advanced economies by long-distance trade. And today's people who are malnourished happen to be mostly people living the locavore dream. You know, they're subsistence farmers in sub-Saharan Africa who are in really dire positions when they have bad harvests. And so the solution then is to globalize our food supply chain more rather than revert to imaginary good old days.
All right, let's go to another caller here, Champaign County. This is line number one. Hello.
Yeah, I think that you just take too much faith in the market. I mean, I'm not. You don't even have to be an anti-market activist or quote unquote or a socialist to say that there has been monopoly control and manipulation of the economic system in such a way as the competitive advantage is basically being able to, you know, have corn subsidies and ethanol subsidies and things like that, which are very distorting. And I'm not actually advocating a market system. I think that we have more complicated needs and we have more complicated ways of solving things with the information technology that we have. It's actually more possible now than ever. But I wonder where you're, if you got a grant from Monsanto to write this too, by the way. I don't know exactly how you're funded, but the general sense that we should not be shipping things from the other side of the world as a routine, I think, is a good idea. And steamships can maybe get pretty close to us and through the Great Lakes system, but there's still a lot of infrastructure that is very energy intensive. And to the extent that we can change things, I think that we should. And I think that localism is nothing to be lampooned with the swastikas and hammers and sickles. And sounds like a very politicized PowerPoint, actually.
Well, I don't think it is. I mean, I did not make up that thing. I just took it on the web. Regarding Monsanto, all I could say is I wish. I mean, the only money I got to write that was from my book publisher, and I bought my house in a Toronto housing bubble. We still have a housing bubble in Canada, and trust me, I could use the money. But I can tell you that what we wrote in the book is that we sincerely believe, and that there was no corporate hand. You know, I'm not a sock puppet for anybody. And but there are a couple of things I want to address here. We're obviously not defending agricultural subsidies, and ideally we would like to get rid of them. We're Canadians, and trust me, we do suffer from U.S. agricultural policy a lot. We have less subsidies in Canada than in the U.S., but the example that we use in the book as the one advanced economy, the one agricultural powerhouse that has done away with subsidies is New Zealand. And they did that in the early 1980s because they went broke. And what happened in New Zealand? Well, their producers' cooperative became extremely efficient. I mean, Fonterra, I don't know how many U.S. Listeners know about it, is the biggest dairy cooperative in the world. It has about 11,000 members. So you have a lot of small farmers, a lot of small producers in New Zealand who can gain economies of scale in that process and are able to dominate the world dairy market in places like Asia and many other markets. And when you talk about corporate control, well, of course, this has been the typical complaint of farmer for over a century and a half now. But look at the numbers. I mean, the same basket of goods today, as far as food is concerned, is only about a third of what you would have paid in the 1950s. And if you go back to the middle of the 19th century, the same basket of goods today in terms of good quality nutritious food is only about 1/13 of what you would have paid at the time. And importing things from the southern hemisphere does make more sense than having heated greenhouses to produce them in the north. I mean, again, a century ago, many cities were still mostly fed from local producers who used greenhouses, who used other things. But people came to realize, well, nature does provide heat for free, whether along the Mediterranean, if you're in Europe, or in Florida or California, if you're in the United States. And it makes more sense ecologically and economically to grow things where nature does the work for you rather than burn a lot of natural gas or coal to generate heat in a greenhouse. That's just a fact of life. I mean, it has nothing to do with large corporations or with a big agribusiness conspiracy. I mean, we don't live in similar climates, and different regions have different soils and different supplies of water and other types of input. So it makes sense to specialize production, again, in the best possible locations.
Let me introduce again the guest for this hour of Focus. Pierre Desrochers is Associate Professor of Geography at the University of Toronto, writes frequently on economic development and globalization issues. He is the co-author, along with his wife, Hiroko Shimizu, of the book The Locavore's Dilemma. The subtitle is In Praise of the 10,000-Mile Diet. It is published by Public Affairs Books and takes on some of the ideas of locavoreism and really challenges many of those points and asks, in fact, does it really achieve what some people believe that it does? Questions and comments are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. What about the argument that some people would make that it's good if you could produce something where you are, that's good because it creates work for people where you are, rather than having people do those jobs halfway across the world?
Yeah, well, it makes sense if what you produce locally, again, offers the best quality-price ratio. But if you end up spending 2, 3, or 4 times as much for the same basket of food or for the same basket of goods, then you have to understand that you have less money to spend on other things, including other things that are produced locally. So you will create a few unproductive or uncompetitive agricultural jobs in your local economy. I mean, nobody denies that. But you will destroy many more jobs in other sectors. So, you know, you will spend less money at your local ice cream stand, movie. Perhaps your area specializes in making good quality furniture. Well, obviously, you will have to go with cheaper furniture because you can no longer afford something better that way. And again, you have to go back in time. When more food was produced locally, yes, there were more agricultural jobs, but people were much poorer than today. You create wealth by specializing in what you do best and trading with other people. So making people pay more for their food destroy more jobs than it creates. It's not a way to promote local economic development. And then you also have to remember that the people who export food to you will also buy other things from you. So I'm sure that you have a lot of tropical fruits that you purchase in Illinois. Well, let's assume that you decide to grow them in greenhouses and pay 5 or 6 times the amount of money that you would pay if you were to import them from, again, Costa Rica or Guatemala or some other location. Well, obviously, then these people have less money to buy corn and soybeans from you in the first place to feed their chickens or their hogs because you're not buying from them in the first place. So it's a lose-lose situation. You don't create jobs by rewarding inefficient local producers. You destroy jobs.
Another caller here. This is Urbana, line number 2. Hello.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Yeah. I just wanted to make a comment that I think your caller really doesn't understand local and the people that are interested in it. Your premise that it's a move backwards and that it's going to be a return to all of these things suggests to me that you haven't really done any research and talked with the producers and the purchasers of these goods. It's the same argument we've been hearing about organic as being a return to something in the past. In reality, it's a move forward, and it uses technology, it uses breeding, it uses everything. So it's not a return backwards.
Well, if I mean, it is a return backwards because, again, you look at the data. Let's see Paris. I'm French-Canadian, obviously, so I can read the – I've read a lot of historical French material. In the late 19th century, about one-sixth of the Parisian area, Parisian metropolitan area, was still devoted to growing foods. I mean, people were growing pineapples. They were growing green beans year-round. And you cannot do that just by relying on nature in Paris. These people had very sophisticated greenhouse technologies and what have you. And what people are saying today is that, well, we're moving forward with these new technologies. Well, this is how food used to be produced around cities before long-distance trade made these inefficient conditions.
Yeah, I suppose, again, you really just have not talked to the producers and the people that purchase this food because...
Well, I did, because what do they want to do? They want to
do... I've been involved in this for over 25 years. I am a producer of local food.
So what do you do differently
really
then?
Understand.
What is different than in the past?
The methods we use, everything. The technology we use, everything.
Yeah, but you're still not competitive.
We are competitive.
So, okay, so if I go to your farmer's market, can I find tomatoes as cheaply as I imported them from other locations?
You're not comparing apples to apples. Our tomatoes people want to eat.
Okay, so then what's the problem? Let people buy local tomatoes if they want to. I have no problem with that. If people think
they
that it is better that way. But you cannot scale up these things without having a significant environmental impact.
And it's a return to the 1920s or the 1950s. It is not. It's people making decisions with their food dollar, what they wish to purchase, and purchasing the quality and supporting their local environment the way they want.
Guys,
I'm interested in having some dialogue between the two of you, and this is great, but if both of you are talking at once, nobody can understand either of you. So I guess in a sense I'm with the caller in that I don't understand what's wrong with that with what he's talking about.
Okay, well, it's just truth in advertising. I mean, if you want to scale up the type of local system that these people want, you will need, in a place like Central Illinois, heated greenhouses. So if you buy local tomatoes in the hope of helping the environment, instead of importing them from Florida, California, Texas, or, you know, more southerly locations, you will not help the environment. It's just a matter of truth in advertising. If you pay twice as much to help local farmers, it is your choice. But if you do it to create local jobs and help your local economy, you will not achieve that result. And again, if local food is better quality, then that's one thing. But you're only catering at very wealthy people. If you want to scale up local food, food will end up being more expensive. There's no way out of that. Again, we would not be trading food over long distances if this was not the case. And you will end up hurting people with lesser means. You will not help your local economy. You will hurt people with lesser means, and you will create and you will have a less prosperous economy overall. That's all we're saying. If people want to do it and are aware of these facts, fine. But don't pretend that local food will deliver benefits when it doesn't. That's all.
Well, our guest in this hour of focus is Pierre Desrochers. He is an associate professor of geography at the University of Toronto. And we're talking about some of the ideas that you will find in his book, The Locavore's Dilemma. It is published by Public Affairs Books. Let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Focus.
Former Major League pitcher Bob Ojeda writes that he's lived with pain in his left arm since he was 12 and started pitching in Little League. On the next Fresh Air, Ojeda talks about the glory and pain of pitching. Also part two of our interview with Sandra Katz about fermenting foods and beverages. Join us.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the Sousa Archives and Center for American Music, breathing life into the history of our nation's musical past through exhibits, guided tours, and performances at the University of Illinois. More information is available and visits can be scheduled at 217-244-9309.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're here weekday mornings from 10 until noon. We have 10 different topics every week. Tomorrow morning in the 10 o'clock hour of the show, we'll talk with Catherine Newman from Johns Hopkins University about her book, The Accordion Family, Boomerang Kids, Anxious Parents, and the Private Toll of Global Competition. And what she does is take a look at families, not just in the United States, but families all around the world that are having a difficult time, that is, the children are having a difficult time managing to make it independently and having really to continue to rely, even as grown-ups, on the resources of their families. That's tomorrow morning at 10. We'll also talk Thursday with Sarah Lawrence Lightfoot. She's professor of education at Harvard, and we'll talk about her book, Exit, The Endings That Set Us Free, talking about managing big transitions in life, like retirement, things like that. We're here weekday mornings from 10 until noon. We have 10 different topics for you every week. You can check the schedule by going to our website. That's WILL.illinois.edu. You may also listen to many past programs there. You can also follow us on Twitter at Will Public Media. In this hour of Focus, we are talking with Pierre Desrochers. He is Associate Professor of Geography at the University of Toronto, and he is the co-author of the book, The Locavore's Dilemma. The subtitle is In Praise of the 10,000-Mile Diet. Public Affairs is the publisher of the book. There's a website, by the way, for the book if you're interested in taking a look at that, and that's globavore.org. So globavore.org. We have some other callers, and we'd be happy to bring some other folks into the conversation here at 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. There's email as well if you'd like to send us a thought that way, will-talk@illinois.edu. We have another caller here in Urbana. We'll go there, line two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I wonder, has the guest ever read the Yearbook of Agriculture for, I believe it's 1979, it might be 1980. It was the last put out by the Carter administration. Secretary Freeman put it out. Have you read that?
Sorry, not only was I still in grade school in those days, but I didn't speak English, so I'm afraid I missed it.
Well, you missed the seminal study of efficiency then. The finding was that medium-sized farms were as efficient as very large farms, perhaps more efficient, and that in California, a small farmer with 35 acres growing truck crops was more efficient than the very large farms. So the efficiency of local farms, given the proper technology, would seem to be right up there with large farms. What you're also missing is that the grower of vegetables in Mexico or South America is not adhering to the same strictures on pesticides. And any of the large or small American growers will have much safer produce than that which is being imported and not very stringently inspected.
Okay.
There is also the problem, my final point, that the effects of these large farms has been disastrous for the native Mexican and South American farmers who are forced off their land and have nowhere to go for income. Jeffrey, I would care to hear your comments. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Well, a couple of things regarding the medium farm being as efficient. I didn't read that specific report, but this is a common complaint. And again, you look at the data, and the trend is unmistakable. If you produce commodities that are aimed at a mass market, there are such things as economies of scale. And typically, the small farms that survive are those that have niche markets. Let me use a parallel, let's say, with the auto industry. You know, in the U.S., you're happy to buy your cars from GM, Ford, and large manufacturers for the masses. And then very wealthy people might buy their cars from Ferrari or smaller outlets which specialize in high-quality products. The middle producers like Volvo and others have been absorbed by larger conglomerates. Food is no different than any other industry. There are economies of scales because otherwise you would not see people, again, you would not see those large things emerging. The one alternative that you see that works in the real world in farming are producers cooperative. I was already telling you about Fonterra in New Zealand, but again, the only way those 11,000 small dairy producers could be competitive on a world scale was to band together and develop economies of scale. So I don't buy the argument that medium farms by themselves can survive. You look at agricultural system the world over, if you want to be in a mass commodity market, you need economies of scales. They exist, and the only way they can survive as small farms is targeting niche producers. Now, the idea that food produced in a less advanced economy is less safe than the one produced by small American farmers is, again, not true. I mean, look at the biggest lethal food outbreak that you had in the United States in the last generation. It happened last year. It was a small cantaloupe producer in southern Colorado. I don't know how many of you followed that listeriosis outbreak, but it was it claimed the lives of at least 25 people in the United States and probably more. And what happens is that people are obsessed about pesticides, but they forget about things like salmonella, E. coli, listeriosis. That are the things that actually kill people. Pesticides don't. And there are, again, significant economies of scales in tracking down those problems. Food safety is actually much easier to achieve in a large operation that can afford a large number of specialized people who can actually recognize salmonella under a microscope. A small farmer, no matter how well-intentioned he is, has a much tougher time dealing with that. And salmonella and E. coli are all around us. They're all in nature. And we need to have checkpoints and economies of scale in food safety. Our food supply today kills on average, again, these are rough numbers, 100 times less people proportionally than a century ago. And regarding the fact that you don't know what is imported from other countries, you should read what the Canadian food activists say about American food. I mean, they're convinced that Americans are careless about their use of pesticide, that they're poisoning their customer, that they're much fatter than us. I don't have a problem eating American food. I trust you guys. But Local Food Activists Canada and us say no and say that you are really the second worst thing in the world after China, where they will put, you know, lead paint in your food or something. So, again, it is not because food comes from a distant location that it is necessarily worse for you. It is how it is produced. And typically the produce that we get from less advanced economies has often benefited from investment from more advanced economies, large transnational corporations, which do use the best and safest way to produce food. And again, if these foods were killing people, we would read about it in the news. But what we see instead is that, again, these little food outbreaks are still connected to salmonella, E. coli, listeriosis. And they're typically from things that are produced in small operations because they were not able to detect them in the first place.
Well, I'm sure that though that there are people who would mount counterexamples and say that in fact there have been examples where foodborne illness has been tracked down to some very large processing plant.
Well, of course, but that's the thing; it's been tracked down, and often it is. Well, but that's the beauty of the barcode and the modern globalized food supply chain. We cannot avoid these problems. I mean. These evil things have been around us much longer than human beings have, and they're all around us in nature. But the thing is that we're able to track them down to large corporations, but often a lot of people will get sick from food bought at local markets, and you cannot track them down, and that's the difference. We feel today that there are more problems than in the past because we have barcodes, because we have a 24-hour news cycle, because we can know quickly what the source of the problem was. But the problems are not getting worse. Things are actually improving, but they're getting more media coverage because now we can actually track them.
Well, I'm sure, though, that people would say, though, again, because if you have one large producer someplace and it's shipping all over to a very large geographic area and you have one person getting sick in Illinois and somebody getting sick in Kentucky and somebody getting sick in Ohio, all from something that was produced on one large producer, it can actually be rather difficult and can take a lot of detective work to put all of those people getting sick together and then figure out that, in fact, the source was one large producer.
And actually, we have a whole chapter arguing against that very point in the book. What we show is that it's the exact opposite. You have controls in a large firm at every step of the productive process. You know, when the food is delivered, when it is processed, when it is shipped out. And again, you can track these things much more easily. What happened in the listeriosis case in Colorado, I'm oversimplifying here, but we explain it in more detail in the book, is that the local cantaloupe producer was taking his cantaloupe that were not fit for human consumption to a livestock operation. And when they did that, his pickup ran into some manure there, which he brought back to his processing plant where the doors were open, where the processing equipment was within reach by, you know, a giant manure that was blown in by the wind. And this is probably how the whole contamination occurred. This thing would have never happened in a large-scale facility with state-of-the-art safety measures. And again, people don't realize that, again, E. coli can often be traced back to, let's say, somebody spreading manure in a field, and you have wild pigs running over to the organic field growing some lettuce or something else, or else the wind might blow stuff, or else, you know, the way people process food at a local farmer's market, you know, different kinds of meat on the same cutting boards. These issues are much more complex than people imagine. And again, I'm not making this up. I'm just quoting your Centers for Disease Control, which has an elaborated website explaining the real problems related to food safety. And the argument that you just made that, you know, mingling everything in a large facility actually accentuated the problem. No, actually, we can detect the problem and track it better than when there is a strict, than when there is often no control at the local farmer's market, where more people in the end will end up being sick than when the problem can be tracked at a large-scale facility to begin with.
Let me just, again, a point here that someone makes in an email. They're noting your affiliation with a free market capitalism think tank, and they say that they would expect that you'd be passionate about encouraging entrepreneurship and new business models, even if only on a small scale. Are you hostile to those kinds of business innovations?
Well, of course not. Why would I be? I mean, but what I'm telling, what I'm trying to tell people in the book is that small producers that will typically be successful in a local market will typically target wealthier consumers. You cannot have a small business and provide, I don't like the expression, but let's say, provide food for the masses or for people of lesser means. So I'm all for small farmers producing, you know, arugula or very fancy tomatoes that will be 3 or 4 times the price. If they can make a go of it, fine. But if the whole goal of the local food movement is to increase local food security and provide better nutrition at lower price, well, I'm sorry, you won't be able to do it. You won't be able to deliver reasonably acceptable quality food at low prices. You need economies of scale to do that, and only, again, large producers in the world's best location can achieve that. But, of course, if small local producers can, you know, provide a niche market to wealthier consumers and make a go of it, well, sure, of course, I have no problem with that.
Our guest in this hour of focus is Pierre Desrochers. He's Associate Professor of Geography at the University of Toronto, and is the co-author of the book The Locavore's Dilemma, and it is published by Public Affairs. We have about 10 minutes left, a little bit more. We'll try to get as many callers as we can. We'll continue and talk next with someone in Urbana on line 3. Hello.
Hello. I would actually like to thank your guest today for mounting a really terrific argument against capitalism. First of all, he says that the main argument against local producers is that they would need expensive technology to produce the same food that we're getting now. And I think that one thing that capitalism has done is create markets for food that we don't need. You know, so you're right, we eat a lot of tropical fruits here. That's actually outrageous, especially off-season. And you're right, we would need greenhouses to compensate for localization of production of those resources. But really, we should be changing our expectations of our food supply to begin with. That is really what would move us toward the more sustainable food system. My next point is that he says that the problem with getting food from less advanced economies is, or his problem with the last caller's problem, it was that, you know, it's actually just as safe, which I agree with, because it's the same cost-benefit analysis, which is why further globalization of production won't make our food any more safe. Does that make sense?
I'm not sure I follow the second point, but I could answer the first one if you don't mind.
The second point is that the cost-benefit analysis of getting people sick versus having safe food is going to be the same all across the world. So as long as we use that as the basis for our reasoning on whether our food is going to be safe or not, people will continue to get sick. And so an advancement of the market capitalist system isn't going to make us any safer. My final point is that I actually find it incredible that you're using people of lesser means as an important argument for globalization, because the people are of lesser means are of lesser means because they're getting paid proportional to the exploitation of the people in the lesser developed countries whose labor is what is subsidizing the prices that we get in this country.
Well, there's a lot there. I don't know, Professor
Roche. I'll try to
be quick. Do what you can.
Okay.
Yes.
Well, regarding the argument with seasonality, we should only eat seasonal. Well, again, look at what human beings were like when this was true. Go back again a century and a half ago. Life expectancy in the middle of the 19th century was still maybe, 36, 37, 38 years of age in Europe. You look at the average diet of a German peasant, and I'm talking Germany here, I'm not talking some third world country today. It was mostly peas and lentils and a few vegetables around harvest time. A century ago in advanced economy, life expectancy was 47 years of age. What was even more outrageous is that in places like England and Germany, aristocrats had access to a better food supply, often because they could eat more meat and they had their own personal greenhouses, were several inches taller than the rest of the population. We have a few data on that in the book. And what losing seasonality has done in advanced economy is create much taller, healthier human beings. And it has also shrunk the sizable size difference between aristocrats and the rest of the aristocrats who were better fed and the rest of the population in England. So reverting back to a seasonal diet will mean people who are less healthy and because they're less well-nourished will be smaller and more prone to diseases. There's no way out of that. Defeating seasonality has been one of humanity's greatest achievements, and I don't see why people are not willing to acknowledge that looking at the historical data. Now, regarding less advanced economies, people are already sick there. I mean, look at the sickness data from food in a place like sub-Saharan Africa. It is, again, something like 100 times higher than in the United States. They cannot afford to pasteurize their food. They cannot afford to refrigerate it. They cannot afford the type of food diversity that we have in advanced economies. So people are already sick there. As they become wealthier, their diet changes. They buy more from global markets. And again, people become taller and healthier and live longer and more productive lives, just as has happened in Northern Europe and North America. And then again, the idea that people have lesser means, well, people are still willing to work in agriculture in places like China. I mean, my last agricultural job in Canada was to try to find new immigrants in Montreal who would be willing to go and pick up the produce that the local French-Canadian population was eating. French-Canadians are better educated. They have other opportunities. Nobody wants to work in farming anymore. So if people are not willing to work in farming in advanced economies, why not offer people in less advanced economies the opportunity to earn better wages? Nobody is forcing them to work in large monocultures that are exported to advanced economies. If they do it out of their own will, it is because in real life it offers them a better opportunity to get ahead. You're born a subsistence farmer in a less advanced economy, you know you will live poor and you will die poor. You begin working for export markets, well, chances are that your lot in life will improve, otherwise these people would not do it.
Again, I want to thank the caller. We're getting really short on time. I want to try to at least do one more caller. We'll go to Champagne in line 4. Hello.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
And I know some of the other callers have been giving the guest a bit of a skeptical and hard time, so I just wanted to say thank you very much. I very much agree with a good deal of what you say, and I'm among those unenlightened people who don't understand why it's better to pay $4 for the same tomato you could get for a dollar, or why it is bad to have more choice of the kind of food you eat. So thank you very much, and I will look forward to reading your book.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Well, we'll go to Urbana then, line number one, for somebody else. Hello.
Yes, I'd like to take an opportunity to enlighten the last caller on what the difference is between the tomatoes. The guest keeps talking about these tomatoes that we get and how amazing it is that we can ship them for miles and miles, and, you know, they're just as delicious, but they're not. You know, these things are selected, so they travel well. It's not so they, you know, have a higher nutrition level or actually do have, you know, better flavor. So I think that is a lot of the reason why I want to buy things locally, is because they're picked 2 days before they're sold at market instead of, you know, a month before or 2 weeks before. The second point I'd like to make is that I kind of view this as a security issue almost, that, you know, if we can have food being produced around here, if some global disaster was to happen, we wouldn't have to worry about surviving on corn and soybeans, because that's all that we have the infrastructure to grow. And I'll listen off the air.
What do you think particularly about that argument, that food security argument?
Well, the food security argument does not hold, because historically, again, people were mostly relying on local food. And as I said earlier, you will have bad years. You know, risk management 101 means, for example, when you invest your own money, you want to diversify the type of things you invest in. Well, the same is true with food. People seem to think we have a choice between one local supplier or one local, let's say, type of producer and one foreign supplier. Whereas in the real world, if you want to buy wheat, well, you can buy it from Canadians, Americans, Indians, Australians, Argentinians, and, you know, some Central Asian republics. You can diversify your supply, and you're actually much safer that way. So why should you go gung-ho on local food, make people pay a lot more for their food for something that is unlikely to happen in the first place? And then why don't you just simply diversify your sources of supply? If somebody has a problem, if one part of the world goes to war, well, you can buy your food from other parts of the world, and then you can ramp up food, local food production, if you really need to do so. We have actually another chapter on the war and food security in the book. And just to get back to the argument with local tomatoes and those that don't taste good, well, fine, maybe local tomatoes in season for a few weeks each year are a great thing in central Illinois. What about the rest of the year, though? I mean, if you value freshness, you better get tomatoes from other locations rather than freeze or can or dry local tomatoes. If freshness is the key, globalization is the way to go. And buy them local in season when they make sense. And if they're four times the price and people are willing to pay that much, well, okay, fine, go for it.
Real quick, one more caller here. Line two, this is also Urbana. Hello. Is there a caller there, line two? Okay, I guess that we're not going to be able to do that one. We're coming down to the point here where we pretty much have to close. Just what sort of idea would you like to leave with the people who are listening?
Well, simply that, again, ask yourself that simple question. If things were so great when most food was local, why did we develop the globalized food supply chain in the first place? And second, try to learn about the history of local food. This is a movement that has been coming and going for a century and a half. You had Victory Gardens, you had Liberty Gardens, you had Relief Gardens in the Great Depression. These things never last. People will sort of embrace that fad for a little while, then they will realize, you know what, growing my food is a lot of work. I could do other things with my time. So they last a few years, and then they go. I mean, the people who kept gardening at the end of the Second World War were people who were typically gardening before the beginning of the war. So this movement, like others, will disappoint because it will not deliver the good things that its proponents are advocating.
So you really, I'm sure what you say is true, that gardeners are gardeners, and there are some people who are always going to garden no matter what, and
yes,
there are people who like producing things for themselves, and mm-hmm, there are people who like to patronize local producers. But you seem to be saying you think this is a movement that doesn't really have legs.
Exactly. That's exactly what I'm saying, and that instead of focusing, a lot of local development officials in the United States today are embracing that to create local jobs. I'm sorry, tomato pickers or apple pickers are not the jobs that will take either the United States or Canada in the 21st century. We should focus our efforts in developing other kinds of jobs and let people who are still willing to work in agriculture do it.
All right. Well, I think we're at the point here we're going to have to stop. There's certainly some ideas there here people can examine. The title of the book is The Locavore's Dilemma in Praise of the 10,000-Mile Diet. It's published by Public Affairs by our guest, co-authored by our guest, Pierre Desrochers. He is Associate Professor of Geography at University of Toronto. His co-author is his wife, Hiroko Shimizu. And Professor Desrochers, I want to thank you very much. I'm hoping when I show up at the farmer's market this weekend, people will still speak with me.
Well, trust me, you could be in my position. That would be even worse.
Well, hopefully they won't be throwing things.
Well, I actually live in Local Food Central in Ontario, if you can believe that, in a gardening belt outside of Toronto.
Well, I appreciate you giving us your time. Thanks very much.
Thank you for having me.